Welcome everybody who's either tuned in live or hearing this as a recording. This is the first office hours session for economic history class level 810, I think is what they gave it, for the sovereign debt crisis. Let me just explain for those of you who are new to Mises Academy, or even more specifically to taking classes for me in the Mises Academy, these office hours sessions are not mandatory. If you're taking the class for credit, you don't need to listen to these things in order to get 100% in the class. In other words, I will never discuss something in the office hours session that you need to know for the quizzes or the final exam that I wouldn't have already discussed elsewhere. So this is supposed to be analogous to a college professor having office hours where you just stop by and shoot the breeze. If you have questions about the reading material, obviously this is designed for that, but even more generally, if you just want to talk about anything, that's fine too. Whether it's Dungeons and Dragons, Star Wars, World Cup soccer, you name it. So that's the idea. Typically, if we have a bunch of people logged in, I'll try to cater to the questions that are directly pertaining to the course material, but usually we get through that stuff pretty quickly, and then it's just a free-for-all. Okay, so for those of you who are tuned in already, there's not that many of you right now, go ahead and fire away. While they're thinking of questions to ask, I should say that it's almost hard to choose readings for you guys to do because it's so topical what we're doing right now. Every day there's news coming out of the EU about what country's in trouble and what's the ECB going to do and that kind of stuff. So it won't be so much for this upcoming week number two, because that one's a little bit more historical and theoretical. We're talking about the founding of the euro and the economic arguments for and against having a common fiat currency. But then once we get into weeks three and four, I'm going to have trouble just picking and choosing all the readings to throw at you guys, since there's all kinds of stuff. Okay, Benjamin says, what do you take into consideration before accepting a debate with someone? Do you think there is any negative results from debating lower tier people? I would love to see you take the Keynesian side in an aggressive debate against another Mises professor. I'd buy that one on pay-per-view. Huh. That's interesting. Well, let me break the question up. So for your general point about a debate with someone, I'm trying to think of how to say this. Well, first of all, I'm trying to think of what my position is. So I would not want to, I'm trying to think of really ridiculous examples. This isn't exactly what you were asking, but a related question is there any venue where I wouldn't go give a talk, like give one of my standard talks? So if the Grand Wizard of the KKK wanted me to come and talk about the dangers of Obama's fiscal policy, I would say no, because that would just look bad on my resume. Or, you know, if I'm in a different forum somewhere and someone wants to write a hit piece on me, it would look bad if I had gone and given a talk for the KKK, ripping on President Barack Obama. All right, I'm not even going to explain why that would be, but it would certainly be the case. And, you know, if they offered me $500,000, I would seriously think about it. You know, but obviously in all this stuff, the point is I would be giving my standard talk. It's not like I would get up and say, hey, you guys are awesome. I would just get up and say, well, President Obama did this. I think that was wrong because Austrian theory says da, 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 and we could see unemployment. But if the question is there any place where you wouldn't go give a talk, for sure, for my normal speaking fee, I would not go give a talk to the KKK, even if it's my talk and I'm not endorsing what they're doing and I'm not even pretending that I'm endorsing what they're doing. Just for PR reasons. That could be so easily spun against me, and it would just look bad. It would be hard for me to defend that if they paid me enough money I might do it because then I would just be funny about it when people brought it up, and I would say, "Give me a break. They give me 500 grand. You're telling me you wouldn't give us an after dinner talk for 500 grand or whatever the number was." All right, so that's you know, maybe I'd even donate 100,000 to the NAACP or something just to cover myself in terms of the PR. But other than that, I mean, generally speaking, I am pretty open about I go give my talk to whoever will have it. So I'll certainly go on, you know, Bill O'Reilly or Sean Hannity if they ever wanted me to talk about my books. And in fact, I was really hoping, and the publisher was hoping, with my politically incorrect guide to the Great Depression, you know, that was ripping Obama, comparing him to FDR and saying that's a bad thing. Also ripped George Bush and compared him to Herbert Hoover, and that was certainly not complimentary. And we had that come out right after Obama was in there, and we thought it was going to be a splash and that I would be doing all the standard Fox and Friends kind of stuff, and it just didn't pan out. I don't know why. So I have no problem doing that. I would have no problem going on Rachel Maddow if for some reason she and I agreed on something and she wanted me to, you know, if she wanted me to criticize Governor Perry's economic policies in the state of Texas and to say why he shouldn't be credited for the Texas miracle. I mean, I haven't really studied his stuff, but let's say that I agreed that he was getting too much credit for what he deserved or something like that. And Rachel Maddow wanted to have me on, or Al Franken, or, well, he's in the Senate now, right? But you get what I'm saying. If I was going to be interviewed for a Michael Moore documentary, and as long as the stuff that they wanted me to talk about, I agreed with, and I didn't think they were going to take me out of context and make it look like I believe something I didn't believe, I would do that. I wouldn't care. So, as far, you know, so when you say debating in general, I have no, so to come back to your question, I am certainly not of the view that, oh, there are some people that we would be better off to just ignore them rather than to take them on. Now, there is something to be said. I'm trying to think. I mean, I have done that in a sense. Like some guy, like somebody will send me an email and say, "Oh, you gotta answer this on Mises' Daughter. You gotta write a piece on this." And it's like some punk kid ripping on Ron Paul or something. And you know, I don't bother doing that. But it's not so much like, oh, we don't want to shine a spotlight on him and reward him for making fun of Ron Paul. It's more that if it's no one you ever heard of, and they're not bringing up something particularly novel, then what's the point? You know what I mean? Like if it's the same type of arguments that Robert Reich and Paul Krugman and other guys have made against the gold standard or Ron Paul or Austrian economics, there's no point in me linking to and taking them 2 hours to go through and decimate some punk somewhere. That's, I mean, the only time I ever have that kind of attitude is if someone really is a punk. Like there's some guy in Canada that spends a lot of time allegedly refuting my positions on his YouTube channel. And, you know, he quotes, he like shows snippets from my speeches and then says, "So there's this guy, Robert Murphy," and da da da, and he'll, like, this guy thinks he's blowing me up. And so I don't spend a lot of time refuting him because, you know, I think, well, this guy's an idiot and he's not, who the heck is it? Some guy from Canada that, as far as I know, isn't even an economist. So I don't spend much time, but even there, it's not like I blacklisted him. I think I did link to him for my blog once just because I thought it was funny. So I mean, even there, like, so if I were Paul Krugman and saw somebody made a YouTube the way that I'm doing with Krugman, for sure I would link to it and stuff, and I might even say, well, if it gets to this level, yeah, I'll debate this punk. And in fact, I'm not just speaking off the, or I don't know what word. I'm not making empty boasts. I did do that. Somebody on Facebook disagreed with one of my blog posts one time and challenged me and said, "Hey, we're both going to be a pork fest. I'll debate you there." And so I told him, and that was the same thing, that I didn't know who the guy was. I mean, he's like a Facebook friend, but it's not that the name meant anything to me. And so my first answer was to say, because the guy was an atheist, and so my first answer was to say, "Well, you know, if I was going to debate somebody over the existence of God, it would make more sense for me to debate Stefan Molyneux, who is a much more famous atheist in libertarian circles than you are, and he's going to be at Porkfest too. So that was my first response, that I think he kind of got offended and his friends got offended. And so he came back and he was, you know, trying to give me a guilt trip along the lines of, you're being like Krugman. So I said, okay, fine, if you raise, I think the number I threw out was $1,000 as a donation for the Mises Institute, I'll debate you at Porkfest. All right, so that, I mean, so that's the kind of thing, you know, the way I view these things. I generally don't, and because I know some people think, oh, certain positions, you don't even want to give them the time of day because you don't want to draw people's attention to them, just ignore them. I don't agree with that. Like the MMT, Modern Monetary Theory, I wrote a Mises.org critique of that because I thought this is a very interesting perspective and I thought it was totally wrong. And so in my mind, we should blow this up. Like we should let Austrians know why this is totally wrong and not just dismiss it because it's crazy, but we should go through step by step and point out why it's crazy. And so, you know, I did that even though I think a lot of people would have thought, you know, don't even pay attention to these guys. They're not in any position of power right now. Deal with the Keynesians because they're the ones influencing public policy. So that's kind of my general view. Now, when you're saying would it make sense for me to pretend to be a Keynesian or just more generally, would it ever make sense for me to debate something that I didn't agree with? For sure, what I think can be useful is if you debate something and you just say at the outset, you know, I'm not sure what my own view on this is, and so, but I'm going to give this particular perspective the best defense I can. So it's almost like I'm a lawyer for this position, and as a lawyer, it's not your job to try to weigh the pros and cons in front of the jury. No, you're trying to convince the jury that your side's right and the other lawyer's trying to do the opposite, and you're hoping that if the system is correct and that it's not like one side just more effective as a speaker than the other, that the right position will prevail. So I wouldn't be opposed to doing something like that. Like, for example, you know, the issue of in a totally free market, would an influx of gold cause the boom-bust cycle? I think Walter Block's position is no, it wouldn't. So I wouldn't mind debating him on that, and I would take the position and say it could. Even though I'm not sure. I go back and forth on that because there's decent arguments on both sides. So I wouldn't be unwilling to pretend for the purposes of a debate that I really believe that, yes, it could, and just throw everything I had at Walter Block and not point out the flaws in my positions and just let him point them out if he can discover them. But there, I mean, I would be more hesitant to do so. By the way, guys, if you have other questions, go. I mean, the people who are listening to this are wondering, oh, my gosh, why is Murphy taking so long answering this one question? What a narcissist. Just because they're not asking me other questions. So if you guys post other questions, you don't need to wait for me to finish. I'm kind of dragging this out because you're not posting more questions. I would be a little bit more hesitant to do what you're saying, even though you're right. It would be funny and I think entertaining if I were to pretend to be a Keynesian or to pretend to be Scott Sumner or somebody. Because I do pride myself on trying to really understand my opponent's worldview. And so I think you guys actually were in the last office hours. I mean, I could pretend to be Krugman, I think, and keep Austrians at bay for 10 minutes with all kinds of argument. And in fact, I think I could be Scott Sumner even better. That's why I tell people that I would much rather debate Paul Krugman than Scott Sumner, because I think Scott Sumner's position is a lot more defensible, and it would be really hard for me to find the weakness or the chink in his armor, whereas I think Krugman, even though he's got a lot of bluster and acts like he's invincible, I think actually he would collapse pretty quickly in a debate. Not that he would admit that he was wrong, but I'm saying in my mind, I would have blown him up three different ways, whereas Scott Sumner, when he and I argue online, a lot of times I don't know what to say. like he'll say something and I don't know what the answer is. It's not that I think he's right, it's just I can totally see why in his mind he thinks he's right, and I don't really have a good answer for him. So, in case you're curious, it just means stuff like, and he says, okay, well, if we're about to have the collapse of the dollar and all that kind of stuff, and if Bernanke, you know, if these policies are so inflationary, why did long-term treasury yields go down after the Fed did such and such? You know, why, under your explanation, wouldn't treasury yields go up? Because investors are fearing inflation or, you know, that kind of thing. So I do have, you know, some hypotheses, but my point is I'm not totally sure what the reason for that is. Whereas when it comes to Krugman, when he says stuff, like, I'm pretty sure that what he's saying is totally wrong. And I, moreover, I think I'm confident in the way to deal with his perspective. Whereas with Scott Sumner, since he's pretty much a free market guy in general, except when it comes to the production of money, it's a lot harder for me to pinpoint to my own satisfaction as to, okay, yeah, the reason he's wrong is because X, Y, and Z, that's why he's totally wrong. It's more, come on, you're telling me the reason we're in a recession right now is because the Fed hasn't printed enough money? Are you nuts? But that's not really a very nuanced argument. And he says, well, look at all these factors, and you're telling me that's loose money? No, these are all things you'd expect to see if we had tight money. And he's right. They are all things you would expect to see if we had tight money. So it kind of takes me aback. Okay. So anyway, the only problem, though, with the pretending to be Krugman and stuff is it's a little tricky or dangerous, or I don't know what word you want to use, let me just put it this way. A lot of times when I would teach in my classes, like when I was actually at Hillsdale College and with the Blackboard, or even at Mises University, my rhetorical style at points would be to open up with the wrong theory, show why it was wrong, and then give them what I thought the better theory was. But I stopped doing that after a while because I realized sometimes kids would get mixed up and they would just walk away with the wrong theory that I taught them, and they wouldn't forget or they wouldn't remember what the problems were, and they would just, you know, I was throwing too much information, that was too subtle to give them the wrong thing and then show why it didn't work and then replace it with something more satisfactory. You know, to me, that was the most compelling. That was the way Bumbaber wrote, and I loved it, because he would get you, you know, he'd take the currently fashionable approach or explanation. He would give it a really good defense or exposition, so you were like, oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then he would say, oh, but wait a minute, what about da-da-da-da-da? And you'd say, oh, that doesn't make any sense at all. And then you'd be casting about aimlessly because you wouldn't know what to do, because the way you were thinking about it, you realize it's totally untenable. And then he would give his theory, and you'd say, oh, yeah, that is much better. You know, your theory isn't susceptible to those problems, and you can explain as much stuff as that other theory could back when I thought it was right. So to me, that's the way I liked reading stuff, so that's how I tried to teach it. But especially like at the undergraduate level and for people who weren't economics majors, who were just there to say, you know, I'm taking one or two classes on econ in my life, how am I supposed to think about the economy? I realized it was kind of risky to show them a bunch of wrong analysis and then tell them, now this is wrong, so don't think like that. Let me tell you the right way. That they only had so much room to absorb so much material. And sometimes if I spent 30 minutes explaining the wrong way, that would stick. And that's the way they'd walk around the world, seeing the world that way, because that's what they heard me say. So it would be, if I were in that debate, it would be tricky to know where to draw the line, because you can also play dirty. And that's the thing, too, is when you're in a debate, there are times where you can say something that you know is rhetorically persuasive and that a lot of people in the audience are going to be moved by, even though you know that's a bogus argument, or that you know you did something cheap. And so, you know, ideally, you never have to do that, but I'm just saying sometimes you do have to make that call. And so if you think you're making a slightly invalid argument in support of a position that you think is correct, and so you think, like, okay, yeah, I'm not really dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's. I'm kind of taking a shortcut. It's not really valid, but it's basically correct. You feel okay about yourself that you're just dumbing it down a little bit and you're leading the audience towards what you think is the right position. But if you actually don't believe in the position and you're just trying to win the debate, well, then that's, you know, more dubious if you're being a little bit fast and loose with the truth in order to arrive at something that you think is a false conclusion and you're trying to convince the audience of something you think isn't true. I'm a little squeamish about doing that. So that's, I might not want to do what you're saying, even though I understand. Because my roommate and I used to do that in college. We would practice our rhetorical skills and we would give each other absurd positions to debate. So it was like the most ridiculous one was we were debating like the best person to take to the dance or something. And so he picked like the prettiest girl in school and I picked a frat guy. Okay, and so that was the joke, like, can I debate so effectively that I'm going to prove that actually it makes more sense that you would want to take this frat guy to the dance as your date rather than, you know, the prettiest girl in school. And I actually won the debate. Like, my roommate conceded, yeah, you won that because for his position, he just said something like, what more do I need to say? Just look at the two of them. What, are you crazy? And then I don't even remember what I said. It was, you know, I said some funny stuff, and I came up with all these reasons, like, well, no, if you think about it, he would be superior for these reasons, you know, and I went through. So anyway, so that, I mean, there, it was so outlandish, it was funny, but when it comes to, like, Keynesianism and stuff, you know, it would be tricky, like, if I start bringing up sticky wages, well, maybe we do think that they're sticky wages, and so it would be hard to disentangle what Bob's saying is a joke, and what does he actually believe in, you get what I'm saying? So it's, I might be hesitant to do that. Okay, Lewis says, but very interesting question, Benjamin. And by all means, in terms of these debates, you know, we're open to things. We're not sure what direction to take these things in. So clearly, having me debate Carl Smith, for those of you who don't know where the question came from, it's because on Friday, September 2nd, I'm going to be debating Carl Smith, who is a Keynesian, or at least, I don't know if he calls himself a Keynesian, but he certainly believes in the effectiveness of Keynesian interventions at times. So I'm going to be debating him on that issue as a sort of pay-per-view event for the Mises Academy. So if you go to academy.mises.org, I think is the URL, you can see the details of that. So I think it's $20 to watch the hour-long debate. So that's what Benjamin's talking about. So we're obviously with that kind of stuff, but we're, just so you know, Benjamin, we're not sure, like, some people might want to see more internal debates, like Austrians who agree on 99% of the stuff, but they have these disagreements over minor things. Some people might want to see those fleshed out, whereas other people are saying, no, let's not get into sectarian squabbling, that's just going to be divisive. Let's keep it more, you know, Austrians versus the world kind of stuff. So we're not even sure. So, you know, there's no debate internally about, does it make sense for Bob to go debate this guy Carl Smith on Keynesianism? Everyone's, yeah, that's fine. But we're not sure if we want to go, you know, in that other direction. So for sure, if I said, hey, guys, how about I pretend to be a Keynesian, I believe that would get vetoed right now. Okay, Lewis says, is there going to be a specific course on Mises' theory of money and credit? I'm not guaranteeing that, Lewis, but I think so. I would like to do it because, as I'm sure you know, my study guide to the theory of money and credit just recently came out, so that would obviously be a very useful accompanying text. So, yeah, the problem is, people, we don't know what the demand for that kind of a course would be. And if, you know, if we didn't get at least 50 people, I don't know that it's worth my time to do it, like an 8-week course. If it, shorter things, if it's just a few people sign up, that's fine. But if it's going to be like a long production to go through the whole book and everything, if we didn't have at least 50 people, I don't know that it makes sense for me to do it with my schedule. And I don't know if we would get that many people, because I think people hear the theory of money and credit and they get scared because it sounds hard. And it is a hard book. It's harder than Human Action. It's actually not as hard as I remembered it being, and so I try to encourage people, especially with that study guide, to say, give it a chance. Don't assume that it's too hard. It's actually, if you just, you can't just flip through it occasionally. You can't like look at it one day and come back to it 2 weeks later and flip around and read whatever chapter interests you. You can't do it that way. It's too, but you need to go through it methodically. But my point is, if you're willing to sit down and go through it methodically, especially if you got my study guide to help you, it's actually not that bad. It's not like you ever hit a part where you say, whoa, this is incomprehensible. It's just he keeps building and building on stuff. But as long as you started at page one and you read everything, he gives you what you need to keep going. Again, especially if you're using my study guide to make sure you're absorbing it correctly. So to answer your question, Lewis, yeah, we do. Let me put it to you this way. We're going to do something involving monetary and banking policy, but we may decide it makes more sense for me to reoffer a class in Austrian business cycle theory again as opposed to this. Now, maybe what we'll do is we'll sort of bill it as both and say, hey, we're going to go through theory of money and credit, but we're going to take special emphasis on, or give special emphasis to, the business cycle section of the book. So for those of you who wanted to learn about ABCT but didn't catch the class the first time, this is for you. And now that I'm talking through this with you, I think that's probably what we will do, because that'll be like the best of both worlds. We'll presumably get a decent enrollment, but also get to go through theory of money and credit. So, but this is just me speculating. I need to talk with Danny Sanchez and Jeff Tucker and make sure, because it's part of the problem, in case you guys are wondering, like, why, if you want to do a class, why don't you just do it? It's just because we, Jeff Tucker and Danny Sanchez kind of are the people, the visionaries behind Mises Academy. They deal with it more. I'm more doing my classes, but they're kind of responsible for steering the whole enterprise. And so, we all coordinate before we do a new class. We just make sure we're all in agreement that is this in the spirit of what we're doing, and is the Mises Academy going in the direction that you guys want it to be going in? That's the kind of stuff that we just make sure we're all happy with the way things are going. Okay. As far as though when we'll be doing it, yeah, it would be. Hang on, let me check my calendar just to give you some idea. So the sovereign debt class is over the 14th of September. The Man Economy and State third session starts up on October 5th. So in principle, I mean, there can be some overlap. I mean, we do that a lot, because I don't know if we would want to start, because the Man Economy and State class doesn't end until November 23rd. So I don't know if we would want to start a class, especially that might be on the theory of money and credit, in late November or early December, because I think people are going to be getting ready for Christmas. So if we were going to do it before the new year, we would probably, I don't know. I should probably just stop talking, because I might say something that doesn't turn out to be true. I'm not sure, now that I'm looking at the calendar, when we would start it. It's because we have to worry about not starting it right around Thanksgiving, but then also not starting it too close to Christmas. So I'm not sure. So let me just stop talking on that, because I don't want to lead you to believe one thing. But yes, to answer your question, we for sure are doing something involving Mises' monetary and banking theory, and I would hope that it would be, and that it would involve theory of money and credit. and it certainly would be the next major course. So in other words, we wouldn't introduce some brand, you know, some major course, unless something crazy happened, like the dollar crashed 50% or something, then maybe we'd have a emergency 4-week course on what the heck just happened. But barring something like that, yeah, after either simultaneously or after the Man, Economy, and State third section, that's what we're gonna, that's what I'm planning on doing. Okay, Jerry Stabal saying not hearing or seeing anything. Are you, is that still true? Let me check this. Oh, okay, good. I'm glad, because I don't know what, I don't know what I would have told you. I know there's a way, like, you can set the login and log back out. Okay. All right, any other, let's see. So Jerry, by the way, if you have a question, just go ahead and type it in just in this little chat box for the office hour sessions. Since there's not that many people, we can keep it more informal. Okay, Benjamin says, I really like the office hours because I always get to ask a bunch of questions. It is very generous giving of your time, but it seems that only a couple people generally show up. So would not your time be more productive by taking questions from the chat box for a while after the lecture instead? Okay, well, a couple things. So first, you're right, it does, not that many people show up, but I think, and I don't have hard data on this, so I don't know what the numbers are, but I'm pretty sure a lot of people listen to these things after the fact. It's just they don't tune in because, you know, they got stuff going on Saturday, but maybe when they go to the gym or something, or they drive to work, they download this stuff and listen to it then. So there's that aspect, but even though there's only a handful of people who apparently show up for these, I think more than a handful actually listen to them. The other thing is, I know there are some people that say that's why they sign up for these courses, or, you know, for mine at least, that they, like, that justifies the enrollment right there. So if that meant on the margin those people wouldn't otherwise have signed up, which maybe that's not what it means, you know, for me to give up an hour to get a few more people in, you know, it's actually not that awful in terms of the economics of it. Also, I don't mind doing this. It's kind of fun for me to, you know, have these informal sessions as opposed to, you know, the lectures. I kind of get all amped up before I go ahead and do those. You know, it's a little bit odd when your camera's going and you can look and you see that there's 80 people tuned in watching you and you're giving a lecture, going, you know, it's, you kind of get at it, whereas this, it's more casual because I know there's only a handful of you in here right now. That's why, you know, I have a polo shirt on and we're just shooting the breeze kind of stuff. So I don't mind that. But then you're saying, why don't we do it this way at the end of the official lecture? It's because it doesn't work. That's how we originally did do it. When I first started, you know, the first Mises Academy class, the one that was on the business cycle, we originally did have in the Q&A, you know, we finished the main lecture and then it's okay, type in your questions, and they would start doing it in the chat box, and one person would do it, I would start reading the question, somebody else would submit a question, and it would bump that question up, and so I'd have to, like, hold the scroll bar, like, you know, put my cursor on the scroll bar and hold the button while I'm reading it to prevent it from moving, and then, and then while I'm answering the question, it would get bumped around because people would be posting new questions, and then I'd have to scroll around, and it would take me a minute to find my place. So that's why we moved away from that to the, you know, the Moodle forum, because there I could better control the screen and wouldn't get bumped around. So that's why we do it the way we do it there. What is true is, I would like to have more Q&A on the Wednesday sessions, and the problem is just that I always go long on the PowerPoint. I always intend to end it, you know, 75 minutes into the lecture and then turn over the Q&A, but I always take longer on certain points, and it always bleeds into the time I had intended for your Q&A, and I don't want to make the thing last 2 hours total because some people that's too long. You know, they don't have the attention span for that. So that's why things are the way they are. So I think I'm happy to keep doing the Saturday Q&As. And even there too, sometimes I cancel. Like if I'm at a wedding or something, I just don't do it. So I mean, it's not that big a deal for me to give up 1 or 2 hours, depending on how many classes I'm teaching on a Saturday. Okay, Benjamin says, are you going to cover the criminal aspect of the current crisis in this course? Can you be more specific? So probably from my tone, you're getting the sense that the answer is no, because I'm not even sure what you mean. So can you just elaborate on what you mean? Like, I don't know if you mean banks giving mortgages to people and then not keeping track of the titles and that kind of stuff, or if you mean was the Fed violating statutory laws when it bailed out foreign banks and that. You know, so I'm not sure what criminality you're talking about. And also, other people, if you've got questions, again, just go ahead and type them. You don't need to wait for me to finish an answer. Just I calibrate the length of my answers based on how many questions are sitting in the chat box. So feel free to type stuff. Okay, so Benjamin says, Goldman Sachs and Paulson, for example, building mortgage-backed securities to fail, et cetera. If you wanted to ask me something specific, like not to just say talk about this, but like if you had a more specific question that you wanted to put, you know, in the forum for one of the week, I guess it'd be for week one, I could go try to give you something there, like to find the articles or whatever, but no, I mean, to answer your question, I hadn't intended to talk too much about that, not because I don't think it's important, but just I don't think that's directly involved or related to why right now there's this crisis in the financial markets about bonds issued by a lot of these governments, which is what the course is about. Also, that stuff, it gets pretty tricky, and I'm not a lawyer or a securities expert, an expert on securities law. For people who just want to know what Benjamin's talking about, the big picture is that there were a lot of these companies were bundling mortgages like we talked about in the first week's lecture. So they were buying thousands of commercial mortgages from commercial banks across the country. So local community-type banks would originate a mortgage. A couple would want to buy a house. Some local bank in some podunk city would give them a mortgage, okay. But the bank wouldn't sit on the mortgage. They would sell it to the Wall Street firms. The Wall Street firms would buy up thousands of these things from around the country, bundle them all together, and then slice and dice ownership claims to those incoming cash flows flowing from the mortgage payments. And so the issue is some of these firms were selling products to their customers, you know, these derivative products, telling them, oh, here you go. Well, that's the issue. Were they telling them? We don't know. But they were selling products to them while the firms themselves were betting against them. Like whether, you know, taking out credit default swaps against them or through other mechanisms, taking positions where the firm that bundled these things would profit if these things ended up tanking in market value. And then to make matters even worse, they have, for some of these cases, they have emails that these executives at these firms were sending to each other saying, like, these assets are crap and other naughtier words that they were selling to their customers. So this gets into a real tricky, I mean, for sure it's a public relations disaster, and for sure the customers that bought these things are going to be mad at them. Like, why were you guys selling me something that you behind the scenes were betting against and that you even were discussing as being crap? But is it illegal? I'm not sure. I know Robert Wenzel, when this stuff was breaking, he was sort of giving a qualified defense of what these firms were doing, saying, hey, they weren't forcing people to buy this stuff. They weren't the ratings agencies. You know, it was S&P and Fitch and Moody's that put AAA on this stuff. More, you know, so if some guy in Asia, some financial institution in Asia wants exposure to the U.S. real estate market, and they go to Goldman Sachs and say, hey, we see all these mortgage-backed securities you've been selling for the last 3 years. We want a piece of the action. How is Goldman Sachs hurting it, you know, doing a bad thing by saying, okay, well, here you go. And S&P says, this thing we just gave you is AAA, and we'll charge you $10 million for that. Thank you. Have a nice day. And then Goldman says to itself, we think that that thing's going to go down in value, so let's take a position accordingly. That, you know, what's the problem with that? So it's, but like I say, I don't know exactly what they did. Not, you know, because you could argue it gets real nuanced. Like, if they said to their to the customer, oh yeah, we think this is great, everyone's doing it, and you should too. We're telling all, we're just, you know, we're giving inside recommendations to our favorite clients. And so we're doing you a favor by letting you in on this. This is a very special arrangement. If they did that, well, then you could say that's fraud. And so that's, the you know, in terms of, like, libertarian law or ethics. Okay, but I don't know if that's what they said to them. I'm not saying they didn't say. I just don't know. I haven't read enough about these particular episodes. They probably did. If I had to guess, yeah, I mean, a salesman will say whatever he needs to say to make a sale. So it wouldn't surprise me if they outright lied to their clients. But my point is, the mere fact that Goldman and other banks might have sold products to their customers that then they went behind the scenes and bet against, I don't know that that per se should be a crime. It may be a crime under securities law, but I don't think that it should be. Okay. This is good. We got a bunch of questions that just piled in here. And by the way, Jerry's saying I don't have a question about this course, and that's fine for these office hour sessions. It means you have questions pertaining to this stuff. I'll give priority to those questions, but if we're just twiddling our thumbs and you want to ask something in general, that's fine. Okay, so Jerry says, I was just reading the chapter in the general theory about the marginal efficiency of capital. That's what most people do on a Saturday. Isn't that what Keynes calls the marginal efficiency of capital? Isn't that what Austrians call the interest rate? Well, at the very least, they're very close. Let me think through exactly. Well, I'll say it out loud, and then maybe as I'm doing that, the answer will become clear. What Austrians mean by the originary or the natural rate of interest as it is determined in the product markets is you buy, like, a capitalist who's at the fifth stage, the fifth most remote stage from the consumption good. He buys capital goods from the capitalist above him, and he buys land and labor factors for a certain amount of money. Let's say he spends $100,000 total, you know, hiring factors and buying raw materials and buying other capital goods. And then they go through a production process, and then he sells the capital good that's produced to somebody else for say $110,000 1 year later. And so there you would say, okay, yep, the originary rate of interest at that stage is 10%, because it's like effectively the markup in the price of the capital good as it gets transformed. Now, the marginal efficiency of capital for Keynes, what that says is, if you are an entrepreneur and you're going to buy a capital, invest in a capital good, and that's going to give you a flow of net revenues. So you might have to spend money on maintenance, you know, keeping the capital good in working order over its lifetime. And so you want to look at the net that you're earning off of it, so the amount that it's boosting your revenues over and above how much more you have to spend because now you're maintaining this thing. And so you're thinking, okay, if I buy this capital good right now, it's going to give me a flow of net revenues into the future that's going to stop at some point, because eventually the thing's going to just be scrap. You know, it's not going to last forever. And then right now you say, okay, given the price, the current price, what interest rate or what discount rate do I have to use such that the flow of future revenues, net revenues, is exactly equal right now to the price of this thing? And so that, in terms of accounting, that's what's called the internal rate of return. So it's similar, and there's other, okay, so one major difference there is the Austrians tend to think of capital goods that are goods in process. So the Austrians tend to think of the wheat being harvested and then getting handed over to the miller who turns it into flour, and then that getting handed over to the baker who turns it into big loaves of bread at the wholesale level, and that gets turned over to somebody else who cuts them up and delivers them to the retail store. So there's like discrete stages, and it makes sense to talk about just the difference in prices from one stage to the next. So it's like a one-shot difference, and the interest rate is the markup from one stage to the next, whereas Keynes has in mind a durable fixed capital investment. So Keynes is more thinking of not the wheat turning into the flour, turned into the bread. Keynes is thinking of the baker buying a new oven, and then that oven is going to be used for the next 10 years before you got to buy another new oven to replace it. So that's one difference. And then another difference is, strictly speaking, Keynes' definition is not the price that you have to pay in the marketplace to get the new oven. Rather, it is what's called the supply price of the oven. So it's, which means, what's the minimum you would have to offer the producer of the new oven to induce him to give you an oven? So that actually could be less than the actual market price. Because, in other words, maybe for whatever reason, the makers of the oven are getting more than they would actually require in order to induce them to produce it. All right, so that's, with the time we have right now, it's not worth getting into why he does that. It's because he's thinking in terms of social use of resources. And so he's saying, the true opportunity cost of the oven is what's the minimum you need to pay to get someone to produce it. That's why Keynes is using that concept. So if you adjust for all those differences that I just outlined, are they basically the same thing? Yeah, in the sense that Keynes thinks in equilibrium, investors will keep buying capital goods until the point at which the marginal efficiency of capital gets pushed down to the rate of interest. And so, Rothbard would just tweak that and say, no, you're wrong to think that there's this rate of interest that's out there independent of capitalist entrepreneurs haggling in the market. But he'd say it's because of their time preferences that people look at a particular investment opportunity with the market price structure and say, huh, do I want to buy this oven knowing it will yield me $1,000 in net revenue for the next 10 years? Do I want to pay $8,500 for it right now? And that you consult your internal time preferences to decide, is that trade-off worth it? And then by entrepreneurs doing that, out of that process emerges the interest rate. So that's what you're thinking. Yeah, that's basically right, but I'm just saying again, their model they have in mind is a little bit different, because the Keynesians are, when they're thinking of investment in capital goods, they're thinking of fixed capital that is durable, where the Austrians tend to think of what's called circulating capital, the capital that moves along from stage to stage, like goods in process, as opposed to machinery and equipment that stays put at one stage and everything else flows through it. Okay, we got about 8 minutes left here. Benjamin says, I hear the total cost of the housing bust was about $1 trillion, ramped up to $60 trillion in the derivatives markets. That's why this is a problem. Goldman told Congress that they were long MBS, but it has been said that they had huge shorts in the derivative market, and there has been some talk about Blankfein hiring a top lawyer. So I haven't, I know what you're talking about, because I read that too, that Blankfein, who was the, people don't know, he was the head of Goldman Sachs, I guess what, after Henry Paulson left? And so he's been in a lot of hot water lately, and he just has retained a defense attorney that is brought in for clients that are in trouble. You know, and so that's why some people are speculating that Blankfein might actually do jail time, because the idea is you don't hire this particular lawyer unless you're really in trouble. It's not like he's just going to get a slap on the wrist. Having said that, I haven't read too deeply on that stuff, so I don't know what he's being charged with or if he has been charged formally yet. As far as, you're right, there is this issue. If you look at the loss in wealth, so, you know, if you just say, okay, what's going on? Why do we have this financial crisis? If you're just looking at the change in wealth from the housing bubble per se, it does seem to be a bit of a mystery. But if you just look at the, you know, what's the change in, like, for example, my house. I was an idiot and bought a house in the fall of 2006, and I recently got appraised, and at various points I've tried selling it to just, you know, move into a cheaper place and wasn't getting any takers. So for sure my house is several tens of thousands of dollars and less than what I paid for it in 2006. So if you just say, okay, right there, so Bob Murphy, he lost whatever the number is, I don't know exactly what it is, 40 grand, let's say. Okay, so there's a $40,000 loss in wealth. And you add that up across the country, or if you want to do it across the world, the point is it's not that big. It's, you know, it's in the trillions, or it's at least 1 trillion, but it seems odd that with a global GDP of whatever it is, that would bring the whole financial system to its knees. And so what Benjamin is referring to and other people have brought up is they're saying it's not just the absolute loss, that if it were just homeowners taking it on the chin, or then if they default, the banks who originated the mortgages and then were just sitting on them, and they had to do a write down of whatever it is, 20% on all their real estate assets, that would be fine. But that would have been a trillion here, a trillion there in terms of aggregate losses across the world economy, but big deal. That would be like a decent sized earthquake or something. But the problem is, what some people say, is that there was a lot of leverage going on. And so if you're leveraged, then a change in the price of one of the assets, of the underlying asset, can get magnified and really hurt you. So if you borrowed a bunch of money and then you invested in mortgage-backed securities, or sorry, you invested in mortgages, and then they went down even just, you know, 10% in value, that might totally wipe you out. Because the same reason, the opposite, if they go up in price and you're leveraged, then you make proportionally more money than if you just bought things outright and held them. So that's the risks and the rewards of being leveraged, and so that's what's going on. So people are saying that's what was going on in the mortgage-backed securities. Those things were derivatives themselves. So even if you just held a regular mortgage-backed security, that thing itself, you could argue, is in a sense leveraged. That, especially if you think about it, you know, if you had one of those tranches that were going to take the hit first. So when people thought, oh, okay, we're going to have standard default rates, and we've got 1,000 mortgages in this pool, so every month, if everybody pays their mortgage on time, the payments all come into this giant pool, and then the first tenth of that money we give to these investors over here, they have the safest tranche. The second tenth we give to these guys over here, they have the next safest. Da, 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 da. And then the top tranche, you know, if there's money, if that money is in there, after we paid off the first 9 groups, then we give whatever's left to these guys over here. So they're holding the riskiest tranche. So, you know, why do they do that? Is because they pay less for that privilege than the guys have to pay up front for the privilege of having access to that first tenth of money that comes into the pool. So that means now if things are better than we thought, and everybody makes their payments and there's no defaults or there's very few defaults, then those investors who bought those really risky tranches, they do well, because they paid a little bit up front and now they're getting a lot more cash than they thought they were, so the rate of return on their investment is huge. On the other hand, if default rates are higher than people thought, then those investors might get nothing, because they were the ones that are the last in line for the money. And so if the money just dries up a little bit, those people could go from getting some money to getting zero, in which case their investment could drop to zero, which, you know, meaning it'd be 100% loss from their point of view. So that's what's going on with this stuff, is that even though housing prices only dropped, depending on what market you looked at, maybe 10 to 20%, some people, you know, that was going to bankrupt certain firms because they were in a highly leveraged position where if prices kept going up, they were going to do wonderfully, but if prices went down, it was going to wipe them out. Okay, Jerry says, we get 2 more questions here. Jerry says, but wasn't Bombard writing about durable capital too? Yes, he was. I don't mean to suggest before that Austrians are incapable of handling durable fixed capital investments. I'm just saying, when you go through a standard Austrian exposition of the relationship between capital and interest, and especially if you want to look at or ask what do the Austrians mean about the interest rate being determined in the product markets, I'm just saying the way to think about it to get the concept down is not to picture a baker buying an oven that lasts for 10 years. You're going to get screwed up trying to think of it that way. It's easier to think of a baker spending money buying flour and hiring workers to help him and you know, paying his rent to the landlord to use the facilities, and then taking all those inputs and transforming them into bread that then he sells to somebody next period for money, and now he starts over again. so that every period it's self-liquidating, and then you can compute the rate of return that way. That it just gets, the math and everything gets a lot more complicated if you're thinking about a fixed capital good that contributes over time. Because the reason, in case you're curious, is because you can still do the calculations, but now when you buy, you have to deal with the depreciation of the oven. So now when you try to figure out what's my gross rate of return this period, when you say, okay, well, I spent this much on the flour, I spent this much hiring workers to help me in the kitchen, I spent this much to the landlord to rent the facilities, but now you used an oven for one more year also. So you have to reckon that somehow. You can't just assume that that's free. And so what you do technically is you look at the change in market value of the oven from the beginning of the period to the end of the period. And so just like that's it's an expense, how much did I have to pay to get the flour, you had to implicitly pay for the use of that oven for a year. And how much did you pay? Well, what's the change in the market value of it over the course of the year? So that's, but like I say, if you're just learning the concepts from scratch, that's a pretty complicated curveball to throw at somebody. So that's why I'm saying the Austrians tend to think about capital goods as being circulating capital goods in process, whereas mainstream economists, when they're thinking of capital, they think of a machine that sits there. Okay, last question. Lewis says, were the euro not to make it out of this crash, how would the Eurozone countries manage their ways back into their original currencies? Well, that's a pretty broad question. I hope you won't think that I'm cheating if I say, why don't I answer that next week? Because why don't we look at the opposite, which is how do these countries go from having their own respective currencies to coming under the euro? And then I think we'll be in a much better position to talk about what happens if they go the other way and the euro dissolves and they try to get back to having their own currencies. So like I say, let me postpone that one for now. Okay, thanks guys. I will see you on Wednesday.